Tonight I'm continuing a series through the Psalms of Ascent that I started back in March. As I mentioned then, Psalms 120 through 134 are each labeled a Psalm of Ascent. Various explanations have been offered about what this means, but the most likely explanation would seem to be that these psalms were associated with going up to Jerusalem for worship, especially in connection to Israel's special annual feasts. And so with that context in mind, we come now to the second psalm in this set, a psalm we have prayed together already, but we'll hear once more now, Psalm 121. As we hear from it, please do listen carefully, for this is God's word for us this evening. A psalm of ascent. I lift up my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from the Lord, from Yahweh, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Yahweh is your keeper. Yahweh is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. Yahweh will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. Yahweh will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. This is the word of the Lord. So as I said, our psalm this evening was likely associated with the journey that faithful Israelite worshipers would make to the Jerusalem temple. It was likely something they would sing even along the way. And this psalm, we see quickly, is especially fitting in that context. It's a psalm whose immediate focus seems to be confidence while traveling towards Jerusalem. But as Dr. Jack Collins points out, in the hands of the psalmist, the pilgrim journey to Jerusalem becomes a parable for the life of faith in general. And it's worth reflecting on this psalm then in that way. Now, as we come to it, the psalm can be broken into two major sections. The first section in verses 1 and 2 focuses on the hills and our help. The second section in verses 3 through 8 focuses on what kind of keeper the Lord is. And as it does that, it emphasizes three attributes of God. So that's what we'll consider then tonight. First, the hills and our help, and then second, those three important attributes of God that the psalmist discusses. So first, the psalm begins by drawing our attention to the hills. Read in verse 1, I lift my eyes up to the hills. From where does my help come? And as we read these verses, we need to ask, when the psalmist lifts his eyes up to the hills, what exactly does he see there? Because interestingly, we're not actually told. And there seems to be at least four possible answers to that question. And each possible answer can fit really with what follows in the rest of the psalm. And so, as the text is fairly vague and enigmatic about the significance of the hills, it's possible that the ambiguity is intentional, with the goal that the Israelite worshipers could apply it to a range of different and even contradictory situations as needed. And so, to better understand then the range of applications for this psalm to our lives, it's worth considering the range of possibilities of why the hills could be significant to the psalmist in this setting. And what we see is that the hills could be inspiring, threatening, pragmatic, or idolatrous. The first possibility is that these hills are inspiring hills. In this case, they may be the hills around Jerusalem, which direct the believer beyond themselves and ultimately to God. And in fact, mountains can have that effect in a whole range of contexts. As the Apostle Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, what can be known about God is plain to all people because God has shown it to them in creation. For, Paul writes, his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So, Paul says, people are without excuse. The creation, we're told, points to God and to God's character. As the Belgic Confession puts it, the universe is before our eyes like a beautiful book, in which all creatures, great and small, are as letters to make us ponder the invisible things of God. as we look around ourselves, the visible world points us to the invisible attributes of God. And so the mountains and their power and their strength and their provision of refuge can point us to the God who is our ultimate power and strength and refuge. As a result, the first possibility for our text is that the hills in verse 1 are inspiring hills. The psalmist is looking at the goodness of creation and then looking beyond it to the God to whom it points. That's one possibility of what the psalmist sees, inspiration. Another possibility is that the hills the faithful worshiper sees are perceived not as inspiration, but as a threat. As one commentator points out, the concern may be that the hills themselves are a menace, the haunt of robbers. Travel was dangerous in the ancient world. Robbers could lie in wait in the mountains, while the traveler lower down in the valley found himself in a place of vulnerability. And so it could be that in his journey to Jerusalem, the psalmist sees the threats of a hostile, fallen world, and he feels his own vulnerability in it. He knows that he cannot protect himself, and so he finds himself asking, where does my help come from? In this case, it's the believer's fears and his anxieties that direct his thoughts to God. That could be the case if the psalmist looks up and at the hills and sees primarily a threat. But a third possibility is that the psalmist looks up and he sees not inspiring hills or threatening hills, but rather, we might say, pragmatic hills. And this possibility is linked with the same threat we considered in that last possibility. Traveling, as we said, could be dangerous in the ancient world, and the hills not only provided a possible hiding place for robbers, but they could also provide for travelers a pragmatic advantage, a stronghold of safety against such threats. This is the interpretation that Calvin takes of these words, that the mountains here are highlighted for their pragmatic value. And in that, he says they're symbolic of whatever is great or excellent in the world. This possibility then introduces a more complex thought process in what follows in the psalm. Because rather than inspiration or threats that lead the psalmist to think immediately of the Lord, if the hills are seen pragmatically, then what follows is the psalmist wrestling with the question of where he places his ultimate hope. And he may even be facing the temptation to look to practical helps instead of to God. Calvin, again, takes such a view, and he sees the psalmist as a believer who's struggling with the temptation to look to practical help instead of to God. And that struggle that a believer could have, Calvin says, should not surprise us. He writes, the thoughts of the godly are never so stayed upon the word of God as not to be carried away at the first impulse to some allurements, and especially when dangers disquiet us, or when we are assailed with sore temptations, it is scarcely possible for us, from our being so inclined to the earth, not to be moved by the enticements presented to us. In other words, what Calvin is saying there is that even as believers, when troubles or temptations strike, it's ordinary that our first thought is to look to the things of this world. Just as the psalmist's first thought may have been to look to the hills for a stronghold. The question that Calvin then focuses on is what our second thought will be. Will we keep our focus on the mountains, on our pragmatic solutions alone? Or like the psalmist, will we turn our attention from the mountains to the Lord? And the problem Calvin is drawing our attention to is not, of course, that there is something wrong with being practical, but the problem is our temptation to place our ultimate hope in such earthly practicalities. As good as our practical aids may be, the lesson of the psalm is that there is something even greater that we need. The psalmist recognizes this. He doesn't disparage the hills, but he also doesn't stop at the hills. He lifts his eyes up further from them to the Lord. Our temptation often is to set the practical and the spiritual against one another so that one necessarily draws us away from the other. But rightly understood, we can embrace both. As Calvin points out, our first impulse is usually to turn to the practical, and so the challenge this psalm gives us is not to stop there, but then to have that second impulse, to look also to the Lord. And so we may need to ask ourselves, do we have that second impulse when trouble comes? And if we do have that impulse, do we respond to it as we should? Or do we push it aside and stay focused on the practicalities alone? Because every practical help has its limits. Every practical help can fall short, but the Lord is sovereign. And where other practical helps will eventually fail, He is always able to keep us safe. So again, as we consider the options, the hills of verse 1 may be inspiring hills, they may be threatening hills, they may be pragmatic hills. But fourth and finally, they may be idolatrous hills. Eugene Peterson puts forward this possibility, and he points out that it's likely that for many Israelites traveling to Jerusalem during many periods of Israel's often flawed and very imperfect history, if they were to look to the hills along the road, they would have seen idols there, shrines set up in high places to other gods. It could be, therefore, that this Israelite worshiper is traveling to Jerusalem to worship the Lord. He's experiencing the trials of the journey and of life. Then he's looking up at the idols who offer help to those in need, and he's asking the question, from where does my help come? Because often when we acknowledge that we need help, the idols of our culture are very ready to rush in and to offer us their assistance. If we would just bow down and worship them. And we can be tempted to take them up on that offer. We can be tempted to lose our way, even on pilgrimage to worship, even on our pilgrimage to the eternal house of the Lord. We can be tempted to seek help from the idols of the world around us, found on every hilltop and under every green tree. But in the end, once more, all such hills can offer us falls short. And of course, in the end, all such hilltop shrines are a betrayal of the Lord. Instead, the psalmist reminds us that the idols around us, revered though they may be by the world, have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see, they have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell, they have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. In other words, at the end of the day, such idols can offer us no real help. We can be tempted to forget this, but the psalmist remembers. The psalmist lifts his eyes to the hills, but he does not stop there. At the end of the day, it's not clear in verse 1 what exactly the psalmist sees when he looks to the mountains, whether he sees inspiration, trouble, practical help, or idolatrous help. But in a sense, it also doesn't matter. Because whatever the case may be, he does not stop with the hills. Whatever he sees there, he looks beyond the hills to something greater, to his true help. And whatever hills we may be facing, we are called to do the same. And so we read in verses 1 and 2, I lift my eyes to the hills. From where does my help come? My help comes from Yahweh, who made heaven and earth. Whatever may inspire us, whatever may trouble, whatever lawful or unlawful helps may make themselves available to us, the psalmist remembers that his help comes from Yahweh. And Yahweh is the one who made heaven and earth. And so the psalmist calls himself, and the psalmist with that also calls us, in any and every circumstance, to look to the Lord. So it's worth asking then, what kind of hills are on your mind this evening? What kind of hills lay before you this week? Are you feeling inspired and optimistic by them? Are you feeling threatened and under siege by them? Are you focused on pragmatics and practicalities? Are you tempted to sin and idolatry? Whatever kinds of hills you may be encountering, the psalmist calls you to look to the Lord for the help that you need. That's the first thing we see here in verses 1 and 2. But then it leads us to the next question, which is, what kind of helper is the Lord? That's the second thing for us to consider from this psalm. Having identified the Lord, Yahweh, as our true help, the psalm continues in verses 3 through 8 to consider what kind of helper the Lord is to us. And a key repeated word in these verses is the word keep. We read that Yahweh, the Lord, is he who keeps you in verse 3. He's the one who keeps Israel in verse 4. He's your keeper in verse 5. He's the one who will keep your life in verse 7, and the one who will keep your going out and your coming in verse 8. The psalmist makes it emphatically clear that the Lord is our keeper. But again, we can ask, what kind of keeper is he? How thoroughly or how directly or how often does he keep us? To answer those questions, the psalm tells us what kind of keeper the Lord is by emphasizing three attributes of Yahweh in the verses that follow. The first attribute of God that's highlighted here is especially seen in verses 3 and 4. There we read, "He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." What we see emphasized here is the sleeplessness of God. The psalmist is emphatic, the Lord does not sleep. And in this, he is quite different from us. We actually talked about this last Sunday morning. One thing that it means to be human is to be a sleeping creature. Sleep is part of how we are made, and among other things, it's a regular reminder of our limitations. But here, the psalmist reminds us that God does not share those limitations. Here the psalmist is emphatic. Our care of others is always limited by sleep, but God's is not. If we were determined to guard the thing most precious to us in the whole world, even then it wouldn't be long before we'd need to let down our guard for hours at a time. We would eventually have to be absent from our task in order to sleep. But the Lord doesn't have such limitations. Every moment of every day, the Lord is perfectly alert, tending to the needs of his people. On some level, this may seem obvious to us, but it was not always a given in people's minds. As Elijah pointed out and mocked, false gods like Baal did sleep. Baal was even known to take naps and needed to be woken up by those who served him. But that's not the case with the Lord. That means that whatever struggle we may face, whatever challenges we may encounter, whatever needs we may have, the Lord's attention will never waver from his people. His vigilant care of his children will never flicker or fade. His attention and effort will never tire, but they are constant. And so God's people can close their eyes. God's people can rest. God's people can let down their guard in sleep because they know that God, their keeper, will not. He will never close his eyes. He will never rest from his care of them. He will never let down his guard of them. That's the first attribute of God that the psalmist focuses on here. The next attribute of God is especially highlighted in verses 5 and 6. There we read, "Yahweh is your keeper. Yahweh is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night." And here, what we see stressed is the personal closeness of God. And that's especially clear when these verses are placed in the context of the line that came right before them. Verse 4 referred to God, to Yahweh, as he who keeps Israel. And for some of us, that kind of idea is easier for us to believe. We can believe that zoomed out from a big picture perspective, God is in control and he's guiding history in general. When the large wheels of history turn, God is manning the controls. And verse 4 affirms that. But then, from that big picture, in verse 5, the psalmist zooms in. I think you can make the case that in that first line of verse 5, it's the word "your" that should be emphasized. As in, Yahweh is not just Israel's keeper. Yahweh is your keeper. And then he gets more specific. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. He will guard you from the sun and he will guard you from the moon. In all those ways, the Lord will guard you in particular. As Dr. Collins notes, this psalm makes it clear that God is not just the keeper of the broader community of his people, but he's also the keeper of each individual member within that community. The faithful are to trust God with the details of their lives, not only with the big picture, he writes. Calvin stresses two implications of this, which we find in this psalm. One is that this psalm pushes against the error of emphasizing God's sovereign control without emphasizing the truth that he exercises that control in the interest of what is good for his people. The other implication, Calvin stresses, is that God works not just for the general good, but for our good as individual believers. All sorts of people can affirm God's sovereignty, Calvin notes, but then they question what his sovereign intentions are. It is to combat that way of thinking, Calvin explains, that this psalm makes it clear that God's intention is to work for the good of each one of his people, down to the very details of their lives. And with that, the psalmist stresses that our help, which is for our good, is not far away from us, but rather it's close at hand. We read in verse 5, Yahweh is your shade on your right hand. Calvin writes that this line is given to teach us that it is not necessary for us to go far in seeking him, but that he is at hand, or rather stands at our side to defend us. The immediate presence of God with each one of us is at the heart of this psalm. And that truth is worth some further reflection. It was a favorite theme of Augustine, who said to God, "You were more intimately present to me than my innermost being, and higher than the highest peak of my spirit." God, Augustine maintains here, is closer to us than we are to ourselves. It's hard to wrap our minds around that, but it's also certainly true. To give just one way of looking at it, think for a moment about how you relate to yourself. You often need to search yourself in order to find aspects of yourself. Sometimes you possess a memory, but you cannot locate it. It's in you and yet also far from you. Sometimes you're unsure of how you feel or what you want, and you need to search your own heart in order to find out. Sometimes you know how you feel, but you need to investigate your own heart and mind to discover why you feel that way. We often, and in a variety of ways, can experience what feels like a gap between ourselves and ourselves. But even as that gap exists there, the Bible reminds us that there is no gap between us and God in that way. God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. He knows us better than we know ourselves. That's a theme that is especially captured in Psalm 139, and it's helpful hearing those words in this context. The psalmist writes, "O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down. You are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit? Or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I were to count them, they are more than the sand. I awake and I am still with you. God's presence and help is always close to hand for any external trouble we may face in this world. But the Lord is also close at hand for any internal troubles we may face. And it's possible that the psalmist is trying to make that point as well in Psalm 121. In verse 6, the psalmist speaks of protection from the moon. As Derek Kidner and others point out, the moon in popular thought and often in the ancient world was often linked with people's mental health. It's unclear to me if the psalmist means to make that point, but whether he does or not, it's still true. When we have mental or emotional struggles of various kinds, even as they make us feel separated or disconnected from others, God remains close at hand. He understands our struggles even when it feels like no one else does, even when it feels like we don't understand them. He can sympathize with us even when others cannot. And so, whatever struggles we may face, whether they be external struggles or internal struggles, the personal closeness of God is the foundation of the personal care that God promises to us in this psalm. And so as we consider the Lord as our keeper, first, we are told of his sleeplessness. Second, we see his personal closeness to us. Third and finally, in the last section of the psalm, we are directed to consider the limitlessness of God. In verses 7 and 8, we read, Yahweh will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. Yahweh will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. As the psalmist promises in these verses that Yahweh will keep us from all evil, that he will keep our going out and our coming in, it becomes clear that the psalmist is not just speaking, again, of the faithful Israelites' pilgrimage to Jerusalem, but he's speaking of every moment and every aspect of the believer's life. In verse 8, God promises to care for us in the range of activities we may engage with, both our going out and also are coming in the variety of ventures and enterprises we may pursue, whether inside the home or outside the home. In verse 6, God promises to care for us in the face of a range of different threats, threats both of the day and threats of the night. As Charles Spurgeon puts it, day and night make up all time, thus the ever-present protection described here never ceases. And within that all-encompassing promise, verse 8 also seems to especially highlight the transitions of life. Spurgeon notes, when we go out in the morning to labor and come home at eventide to rest, Jehovah will keep us. When we go out in youth to begin life and come in at the end to die, we shall experience the same keeping. Our exits and our entrances are under one protection. The key emphasis here is that God's care and keeping of us is not limited to one area of life, but it encompasses everything. And this is an important thing for us to recognize. Eugene Peterson points out that if we fail to recognize this, if we fail to internalize this important truth, then we can run the risk of dividing our lives into two parts and then approaching our needs differently in each of those parts. I want to read a longer quote from him. I'll say that the cultural references are a bit dated here. Peterson was writing in 1980, but the point still comes across, I think. Peterson writes, "The great danger of Christian discipleship is that we should have two religions, a glorious biblical Sunday gospel that sets us free from the world, that in the cross and resurrection of Christ makes eternity alive in us, a magnificent gospel of Genesis and Romans and Revelation, and then an everyday religion that we make do with during the week, between the time of leaving the world and arriving in heaven. We save the Sunday gospel for the big crises of existence, for the mundane trivialities, the times when our foot slips on a loose stone, or the heat of the sun gets too much for us, or the influence of the moon gets us down. We use the everyday religion of the Reader's Digest reprint, advice from a friend, an Ann Landers column, the huckster wisdom of a talk show celebrity. We practice patent medicine religion. We know that God created the universe and has accomplished our eternal salvation, but we can't believe that he condescends to watch the soap opera of our daily trials and tribulations. So we purchase our own remedies for that. To ask him to deal with our troubles with what troubles us each day is like asking a famous surgeon to put iodine on a scratch. But Psalm 121 says that the same faith that works in the big things works in the little things. The God of Genesis 1 who brought light out of darkness is also the God of this day who guards you from all evil. And so it's worth asking yourself, then, what are the areas of life where you tend to limit God's help and keeping? In what areas of life do you assume that he's either not able or that he's not interested in helping you? In what areas of life do you look to the pragmatics or the idols of the hills for help instead of looking to the Lord? How have you limited God's care of you in this way? God promises in verse 7 to keep you from all evil. Of course, we know from life and from all of Scripture that that promise does not mean he will keep you from all suffering. As Eugene Peterson puts it, the promise of this psalm, and both Hebrews and Christians have always read it this way, is not that we shall never stub our toes, but that no injury, no illness, no accident, no distress will have evil power over us. That is, will be able to separate us from God's purpose in us. We will still face trouble in this life, but God will work all things for our good. We will still face challenges in this life, but nothing will snatch us from God's hand. We may experience evil, but evil will not ultimately overcome us. That promise is for the details of this life, but it also extends to eternity, as the very last line of the psalm makes clear for us. There we read that Yahweh will keep us from this time forth and forevermore. Kidner writes, it would be hard to decide which half of this line is more encouraging, the fact that it starts now or that it runs on, not to the end of time, but without end, like God himself, who is my portion forever. As Spurgeon puts it, the whole church is thus assured of everlasting security. The final perseverance of the saints is thus ensured. The glorious immortality of believers is guaranteed. Resting in the hope of God's help, assured of God's sleeplessness, his personal closeness, and his limitlessness, we can have hope and we can find peace not just for this life, but for all eternity. Of course, the call to believe this is a call ultimately to faith. The hills of verse 1, whether they're inspiring, threatening, pragmatic, or idolatrous, the hills can be seen. God cannot. But as Dr. Collins notes, one of the goals of this psalm is that the faithful will learn from it to trust the Lord, even in circumstances in which God's care is not visible to us. So where does God's care seem especially unseen in your life right now? If there is some part of your life where you have trouble and God's care seems invisible, then this psalm this evening is for you. As you look to the hills in your life, either later this evening or tomorrow morning or in the next few days, you'll be tempted to stop and to keep your gaze on the hills. Don't. Instead, as you look to the hills, ask yourself earnestly, from where does my help come? Where is my true hope? Where is my surest help? Press yourself with those questions until you're forced to look beyond your own resources and competencies, beyond the fixes on offer from the world, beyond the created world itself, and to the Lord. Because he is your help. He is your keeper. He will not slumber. He is close at hand. And he has no limitations. And once you lift your eyes to him, let your heart grow in confidence, rooted in God's promises, strengthened in true faith. For in God's hands, we are far more secure than we ever could be on our own. For none are so safe as those whom God keeps. Amen.